Welcome to The Crucible, where the Southern African Institute of Mining and Metallurgy gives you a front row seat to conversations with specialists in the minerals and metals sector. SIAM has well over 100 years' experience in and commitment to protecting the professional standards of our industry. Join us now as we discuss the key issues and global initiatives to give you the relevant information needed to make informed decisions, to influence policy that directly affects our sector, and to help our industry grow in an uncertain future.
Hi, and welcome to The Crucible. My name is Ntati, and today I'm in studio with Dr. Frank Crandwell. And today we delve into a thought-provoking topic, range versus specialization, and the significance of interdisciplinary approaches, especially in the raw materials industry. Dr. Frank Crandwell, thank you so much for joining today. Welcome.
Thank you, Ntati.
Just to kick it off, could you give our listeners a bit of a background about yourself and your work, just to get to know you?
So my name's Frank Crandwell. I trained as a chemical engineer at Wits. And after doing a master's degree, I went and worked for Mintec. I was there for 5 years. So in about 1990, I went back to Wits as a research officer for a few months, and then joined the staff as a senior lecturer. And I stayed at Wits till 1999. During that period at Wits, I had the opportunity to spend a year at Impala Platinum, working on the design of the enhanced PMR. And I also spent a year at the University of California in Berkeley as a sabbatical. And then in 99, at the beginning, or sort of towards the beginning, I joined BHP Billiton, and first in their technology side, and then after about a year, moved through to corporate venture finance. So this was venture capital, and I was transferred to London and spent the next while there till about the end of 2001, until there was the merger between BHP and Billiton was happening at the time, and we were a consequence of that that merger. A bad consequence. What happened was that our whole division was axed. So I returned to South Africa, and you know, sometimes when bad things happen, you get a bit suspicious and a bit untrusting of big corporates. So I decided to strike out on my own. And I started CM Solutions, which has gone through an evolution. So at first we started doing, it was just me, and I started doing courses because I needed some way to earn some money. And so that's where specialization comes in, is that you can actually give things like courses. And then I started to employ people. There was a big increase in demand for platinum, and the platinum price went up throughout the early 2000s, and I started getting a lot of engineering work in, and I started employing people. And that's when it really started to become a company. My first employee was a person called Trevor, and then Justin joined, and then Nick joined, and then now it's a team of 40 people. And at first we were doing engineering design, process design, and at one point we realized that we were being hampered by the lack of test work. And so we opened our own laboratory, and that's become the biggest part of the business now is the laboratory. So that's a little bit about me.
Interesting. Quite a diverse profile, if I may say. It also shows how one's career can actually really stretch out and transform as they go. And so just in your experience, how do you see the balance between, you know, range and specialization playing out in your field, again, in the mining industry, and how you have incorporated this in your career?
So when we were trained as chemical engineers, we were encouraged to be both deep and wide. And our degree at the time was very much a scientific degree. We virtually did a BSc in maths, chemistry, and physics. And although the physicists would say we did the easy part, that doesn't really matter. We also did applied maths, you know, so up until most of the subjects to third year level, and the engineering only came in one or two subjects in first and second year, and then most in third and fourth year. So we did the scientific approach, and throughout that, our lecturers in chemical engineering were very much, you need to know both the details and the breadth of the field. And I've taken that on as in my career, the idea that one needs to choose between being a generalist or being a specialist is not one that I've embraced. I've embraced this idea that in the old days, people used to say you need to be well-read. You need to be erudite. You know, and especially in the arts, or the social sciences, that's a very big thing. Mm. To be well read, and I think that idea has rubbed off on me and the people that work for me. We're curious. We want to know everything. And we don't want to just know our little box and that's it. And that's worked out well for us because it allows us to do a lot of work and contribute in a lot of different places. So that's that's been my approach.
I just wanted to, now that you said this, I love that you said that you're encouraged to be both deep and wide. Again, just to have now a definition, if I were to hear this from your opinion, when you define the two terms, like at least in your context, range and then specialization, how would you define them?
To be honest, the term range is unknown to me. The term generalist is what's mm-hmm. known to me, and what is often sort of like encouraged on the business side is you must know a little bit about a lot, and then get the specialists to assist you, and then. On the technical side, you need to be a specialist. And so that's how I understand those two terms, as being a generalist and a specialist. And the generalist knows a little bit about a lot. So it's shallow but broad. So if you think of a very shallow swimming pool or a swimming pool and you only know the top layer, and then the depth is each discipline. Now, of course, you can't know everything about everything. You need other people, and you need to know who to call on in order to get the details. And that's a critical skill, I think, is knowing when you must stop trying to do it yourself and call on assistance from someone else. And that's easier when you're a manager already. You know, in a bigger company where you've got lots of specialists working, but when you're in a small company and you don't have those specialists and it's not clear, you know, then it becomes really difficult. You know, like when do I call on a subcontractor I'm going to pay? That's a difficult question. You know, and then there's a financial implication for that. That's a critical skill to know, is that I don't really know about this. I can't talk about it, and I need to stop. You know, one of the things that's been really interesting in the last little while has been doing expert testimonies for court cases. So I first did one in a long time ago in South Africa. For the High Court, one of the clients hadn't paid a big engineering firm, and I testified on behalf of the engineering firm. Mm-hmm. And then, more recently, I've been involved in another couple of, two, and then there was a third. And the third one, I knew that I could contribute on a technical level. I could interpret all the data, I could look at all this stuff, but you go, if I go and stand in front of a judge, do I really know, or can I really claim that I have the experience? Now, I have the experience in order to interpret all the results, but I wasn't a deep technical specialist in that field, and they would have wanted a deep technical specialist. And so I declined that, and you go, so you knowing the limits of your ability is really important in different there's differences in different contexts as well, that you go, look, I can't do this. But if it was a different context, if it was just consulting to the company, I could have done it easily.
Yeah, so it really shows that one has, I love that, you have to know your limits, know where, where it ends, this is where I can ask for help. And now that we've at least spoken for this moment, I realize that you are somewhat interdisciplinary, and I see that how essential it is in your work. But can you just share even more? I know that you just shared a little bit more of these anecdotes, but I think there are more stories to share on this. Do you have...
Sure. Yeah. You know, like some of these anecdotes are, you know, or stories, I guess, it's much easier when it's about research work, because then you can see the different disciplines very clearly. So I've got two from, you know, like I spent the first 15 years of my life in research, which gave me a good grounding, for the future. It really was good. You know, people tend to shy away from research work and go, I want to be part of industry, I want to get real experience. But actually the research work gave me a set of tools that I really appreciate. But your questions about anecdotes, and I've got two come to mind, you know. So the first one, what happened was that I was doing consulting work for Gencor at the time. I was at WITS. I told you that I'd joined WITS as a research officer, it was a Gencor funded position. And so I got to know Gencor and the staff there. And then when I joined the permanent staff a few months later, 9 months later, I started doing work. I carried on doing work for them and interacting with them, and the work was mainly around gold carbon adsorption, which was a hot topic at the time. And then Gencor was at the same time Gencor was developing a bacterial leaching process, which has now become known as BIOX, and they wanted somebody to do mathematical modeling of this process. So they dumped a pile of probably about a foot high of papers and said, please do a literature survey for us on the different methods of mathematical modeling and stuff. So I got into it from the mathematical modeling side, which is one discipline in a sense. It's one skill set. And then, I went like, well, After a little while, I realized that actually nobody really knows what the mechanism of this is, and how these bacteria interact with the mineral surfaces and how they dissolve the mineral particles, and that was, so that became a scientific question for me for the next 7 years, I think, or 8 years. And that, so what we did in reading all that material, although I was doing it for mathematical modeling, I went like, well, first there's a scientific question that's unanswered. It hasn't been answered for 35 years. This is worth putting effort into.
Sure.
Then I spotted that the tests hadn't been done under controlled conditions. So what happens is that the concentrations of iron changed during the test. And I knew from my previous work that impacts the results. So, and makes the interpretation incredibly difficult. So what we developed was this idea that we wanted a model, even though I was on the path of models and mathematical models, I wanted a model independent, experiment. And what we did was we combined ideas from electrochemistry. So this is where the interdisciplinary comes in. Chemical engineers know very little about electrochemistry, but because of my work at Mintec and some of the things that I'd done, I understood electrochemistry. And what we did was we built an experiment in which we grew bacteria in an electrochemical cell and used the current to control the concentrations in the cell. So now you're combining ideas from chemical engineering, electrochemistry, and microbiology to solve a particular problem. And we eventually solved it. We showed in absolute detail of exactly how the bacteria were working. And we published a huge number of papers, which got, well, 5 or 6 papers that got a lot of citations. Normal engineering papers get at the time 2 to 10 citations. These got hundreds. So it was a real while it was all the stuff that me and the students did, we didn't get a microbiologist on board. We didn't get an electrochemist. We developed the knowledge ourselves and put the thing together ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's one way that you can do interdisciplinary work is that you gain, or multidisciplinary work. You get the ideas, you pick ideas together, use the best that you can find, and you combine it to solve the particular problem at the heart of it.
Sure. It's really big. I mean, you know, some people argue that in today's world, we generally need this being interdisciplinary and at the same time try to specialize in some case. Again, this is increasingly becoming competitive. What are your thoughts on this, especially considering that, you are such a person with a diverse profile? People want to... Let me start the question again. They start arguing that at least it's more important for one to be a specialist in something, for you to fit into this currently evolving world. What are your thoughts about this?
I'm going to answer this with an anecdote and then try and make some sort of conclusions from it. I remember when a friend of mine was retrenched in the 90s, and he was doing some work for an NGO on developing school materials and things like that, the project, the NGO that he was working for, ran out of money, and he suddenly was stuck for a job, and he started to be interested. At the time, computers and networking and things like that looked bright and flashy and attractive for somebody. And one of our other friends said to him, "Look, Charlie, you need to specialize. You need to get a skill, and that will ensure that you're always employable. Get a skill that is in demand and that you're really good at. Make sure that you're really good at it, and that will make you employable." And it did. It worked for him until his 30 years later, till his retirement. And I think that is a it's a very useful bit of advice. Specialization allows you to be employable, and especially if it's an in-demand a skill that you've got, and that you keep current with it. You you form a defense against the economics of the time, and we've seen a massive changes in the last 30 years. In the last 20, the crisis of 2008 that really struck in the raw materials industry that didn't really affect us until about 2012-13, when the prices really dropped and we struggled. And every now and again there's another recession that we go through, and that means that your source of income, your job, is under threat every time that happens. And so I think getting a specialist skill is really important for individuals to form a barrier against the harshness of the economic times. Mm-hmm. So that's on the one hand, but on the other hand, we also need people that are generous, or people that are well read, let's put it that way, that are erudite, that know a lot about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And there are different periods in your life where you might specialize and then broaden and then re-specialize and then re-broaden. And that's what I think has happened with me, is that, we delved into that bacterial leaching story that I told you about, the long story that I told you about. And that was a period of specialization. Although it was getting a multidisciplinary approach, it was still specialization in bacterial leaching. And then I jumped out and went into venture finance for BHP Billiton. And that's a very broad area. You need to know a little, and then dive back into building a business. And so you need to be a specialist and also flexible and also curious about the world, that you learn more. You can't just go, oh, well, that's my specialization and I'm going to do that and I'm in this box. That's a recipe for heartache at some point as well.
That's true. I think you're already somehow answering the next question I had, because I was going to talk about how do we build a balance in between, just to keep that balance in between being a specialist and also a generalist at the same time.
I think that part of being a balance is so part of being a generalist is to be able to develop rules of thumb. And while I'm a chemical engineer working in the extractive metallurgy industry, throughout my career, and with the help of my colleagues, I've got a whole bunch of colleagues that are really good. Ben and Nick and all the others that have been part of my journey with CM Solutions. We have an idea of how things work in our industry, and we know quickly. You design this on this rule of thumb. Roughly, you can get the size from this, or the piece of equipment from this, or these are the things that matter. And I think that helps. Once you've got a set of rules of thumb of the area in which you're working in, and beyond that, you're able to make decisions quickly. These rules of thumb are heuristic, so that you can make decisions based on limited information, but the important information. I'm working with some guys in France who are trying to find nickel deposits, and then they're all exploration geologists, and I'm not an exploration geologist. So that's again nice interdisciplinary. So they brought me in as a specialist, And then they go, well, can you process this type of ore? And what we've done is we've developed a set of heuristics, you know, of what's important for processing this nickel ore or this nickel laterite, for example, through an HPL process. These are the things that we must target. And you go, that's the sort of knowledge that allows you to become a very good generalist, because you know all the important stuff. There was a series of books that were popular in the 80s when I was and maybe they're still popular, but they were called Bluff Your Way. And I was given a copy of Bluff Your Way. I was interested in photography, like everybody was interested in photography and still are, you know. But it was Bluff Your Way in Photography. They were short books, but they had the essence of all the, I mean, it was as a joke, really, it was beyond a joke, because it actually had all the essence of some of the important things that it, you know, some of the important technical developments, some of the important photographers, some of the important art that's been made with photography and things like that. So you could talk in this as if you were well-read and the erudite fashion, but all you'd done was read this small book of 50 pages. And I think that's what we need to develop is the Bluff Your Way guides in our various fields, so that we know what's important and how things are going to change and know how to interpret things.
Well, yes, I think for a while we had now dummies for something, so photography for dummies, or I don't know, engineering for dummies. They usually had it something like this, just to get people actually acquainted or at least oriented in the subject. And I personally would say that I'm a person with such a broad profile, and sometimes I even struggle when people ask, what are you? You ask yourself, I do this and that and that. But I know that people always want a very specific answer for you to say that I'm a chemical engineer, or I am a metallurgist, or something like this. Yeah. So just to also go back to now, like, you know, I'm remembering the story you told us about the bioleaching process. Just looking at the industry in general, if you can think of anything, do you think that generally interdisciplinary approaches have really led to some innovative breakthroughs or some improvements within the sector itself, within the mining industry, or at least in your field?
Yes. So the developments always happen on the edge. The edge of the field, you know. So often it's not this massive breakthrough but a gradual chipping away, and then suddenly you see, oh, we've got something that's completely different. But you know, bioleaching itself was a process that was interdisciplinary and slowly over the period of the 70s, 80s, 90s, they got that working. The changeover from the old Merrill-Crowe process in gold to carbon adsorption, I'd not say it's interdisciplinary, but actually, it sort of is, because people had suggested using carbon adsorption, and it had been poo-pooed, and then eventually we chipped away at all the problems, and Anglo American and Mintec were instrumental in chipping away at the various bits and pieces of what eventually became a very common worldwide process, even though it had been first used in the States, the real problems were chipped away by Anglo and Mintec to make it a proper process. So, and something that worked and could be used reliably. And it's, so that's often the way it works in our industry. It's not something that, and we can see as the industry becomes more mature, that's how things develop. One of the things that's interesting is the need for in-house research labs within the mining companies. And I worked for BHP Billiton. I came through the, I didn't work for Glencore, but Genkel. I worked for Fitz, but we were funded by Genkel. And then I joined Billiton, and they had a research lab. But they closed the one in Krugersdorp and built something next to Mintec as a strategic venture to get the benefit of being close to Mintec. And then after the merger with BHP, those research labs were completely closed. BHP closed all their research labs across the globe. Other companies have done the same and sort of outsourced it. And this, I think, is one of the only ones that have kept their labs open has been Anglo American. And I think this is a shame, you know, because actually there's so many problems and things that need to be chipped away at. That you need a research lab that's in-house. And look, and I've benefited because I've started a research lab. That's what CM Solutions is. But I think it would be better for the companies to have their own research and so that we can develop and improve. But that's also, it's a worldwide thing. You know, IBM used to have their own research labs, and in fact, they won many Nobel Prizes. AT&T, which is the big telephone company in the US, also had their own research lab, also won Nobel Prizes. But neither of those two are existing anymore. But as the industry becomes more mature, and we live in quite a mature industry as mining and metallurgy, certainly the metallurgy side, that it's seen as less of an important part of the business. But you know, going forward, I think there will be, just like I've talked about the gold carbon absorption, there's going to be, what was driving that was the lower grades. And actually it opened up a huge amount of deposits around the world that were lower grades. So now there mines all over the world where there weren't mines 100 years ago, and I think that there will be an opening up of opportunities through research work in our industry as the grades go down and the demand increases for going into ore bodies that are much lower grade.
Maybe one of my last questions to you, with how things have evolved, we now have started using a lot of AI to better our work, to try and at least know more on things that we would not otherwise know about. How do you see this? Like, have you started doing this the same yourself, just in general? Because back then one would read a lot, and now people have this chance of just saying, okay, I can just ask ChatGPT, for instance.
Yes, it's, you know, there's opportunity and fear in AI.
Hmm.
And one of the, so if you think of a medical doctor,
yeah.
who he's got a lot of training, he or she, most of the people coming into the surgery or the practice have got minor complaints which are easily identifiable by what's going around at the moment. Yeah, well, you've got a virus, or you've got your strep throats going around, and that those GP practices are, I think, you could AI the whole thing. You know, and so that job as a general practitioner of medicine could be seriously under threat, especially if you've got a database, you know, like if you've got a national health system, and you've got data from of what is going around. So in the same way, I think that a lot of our professional services might be under threat from a similar sort of argument. You know, we could codify. It might not be thoroughly AI, but with the doctor thing, there's you need the AI for a database or source of data, and I think that in our engineering field that could well be the case as well, that we if you take engineering design, for example, on the process design, you go, well, we've done 400 projects. Let's put all of that information, all of those drawings, all of that stuff, all of those process design criteria in, and use that as a database of information. And you go, well, could I not, with click of a few buttons, actually do a process design? At least to a PFS level, for example, that could be the future. So that would be a threat to a whole bunch of process engineers. But on the other hand, those people would then specialize in something else. And as time moves on, so I think that there are opportunities to streamline professional services using AI if you've got the information already in your company's databases, and you can. Well, it would require pulling it out and in a form that's searchable and can be used. That certainly would be one of the things that I think is going to be a threat to our world. But I think that will just push people into a different specialization that would then become an opportunity. So you're going to need people that operate those AI systems, that develop them. Well, first of all, develop them, then operate them, maintain them. And things like, and that's a whole different bunch of specialization that would be required. So I think that they're both threats and opportunities.
Yes, because I was wondering if, in general, when you have people that are generalists, of course, yes, they work on different things, but do we see this now as a threat towards their careers, or at least their jobs, in the near future in this regard?
I think that most of us do more complicated things than current AIs can just suddenly take away our jobs. But the AI systems and the application of them to specialist areas is going to grow. And we're going to have to develop along that line. So much the same way as you look at fluid flow. Fluid flow, I was reading, or actually I think it was a YouTube video, by this mathematician. She was really interested in fluid flow, so she studied it, and then she thought, oh, well, she'd like to work in that area. So she got a job in that area, and then suddenly discovered that no, nobody does any of the maths. It's all done with programs, and there's no real mathematics or mathematicians involved. So it's all a solved problem in a way. So she needs to move on to something else if she wants to stay as a mathematician, or adapt and use the programs. And I think that that's what's going to happen to us as well, is that we're going to either use the AI, develop the information or maintain the information for it, or we're going to move on to other specializations. And we can't predict what those other specializations will be, but they will be there.
They will definitely be there. Thank you so much, Frank, for such an insightful discussion. Again, thank you for sharing your expertise and, navigating this topic with us. Of course, we're still would have more questions to go, but I am really, really happy that we got to have this discussion so far. Do you have any final thoughts that you can share with our listeners before we close this one?
Well, no, I'd just like to thank you, Ntati, and SRMM for the fantastic job that they do. They really are a stunning organization, and it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been really good. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Do follow us again and subscribe to The Crucible on all your streaming platforms. And we'll take it from here. Next time, let's see you again.
Thank you for listening. Please note that the facts and opinions expressed are those of the individual and do not reflect the position of SIAEM or the corporate institution.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.